Today is Thursday, October 29th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, there are 5 days left until voting finishes in the U.S. elections.
So Joe Biden sees the opportunities to add states to his electoral count, while President Trump has been backtracking and trying to make sure that the voter turnout in states that he won in 2016 will come back and vote for him again.
Also ahead, another knife attack in France. Plus, scientists discover a new coral reef in Australia. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in the U.S. With 5 days to go until voting finishes in the U.S. election, the Trump and Biden campaigns are trying to drum up every last vote from their supporters. The latest average poll data show Biden leading Trump nationally by more than 7%. For more on the two candidates' campaign strategies in the final week of the election, I spoke to VOA executive producer Steve Reddish here in Washington.
President Trump has been campaigning in states in which he won in 2016. Instead of trying to expand his voter appeal, he's been going back to Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania for the most part, in trying to get his own voters, voters that he knows are supporting him, trying to drive up voter participation and voter turnout in areas he already knows he has voters. On the other hand, Joe Biden is trying to expand the map. Tuesday, he went into Georgia. No Democrat has won Georgia since 1992. So Joe Biden sees the opportunities to add states to his electoral count, while President Trump has been backtracking and trying to make sure that the voter turnout in states that he won in 2016 will come back and vote for him again.
So basically, Trump is playing defense, trying to hold the places he won in 2016, while Biden is going on offense, trying to get more states.
Correct. Biden sees the opportunity to, much like Hillary Clinton saw in 2016, to try and add on states to what he sees as an already growing voter base, and trying to help Senate candidates and other candidates, other Democrats running in these usually red, reliably Republican states like Texas and Georgia, to try and find new voters and help local Democrats in that state raise their base. Hillary Clinton was criticized for doing this in 2016. Instead of concentrating on states that she knew and the campaign knew were going to be tight, like Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania, Hillary Clinton went and tried to grab off some voters in Texas and in Arizona.
Now, Hillary's strategy, which did not work, was in part based on polls, which showed her leading Trump by quite a bit. And again, this year, polls show that Biden is leading Trump by quite a bit. How much trust should people put in these polls?
There have been a lot of criticism about polling, especially from the 2016 election, where polls showed that Hillary Clinton was leading nationwide in the vote. And those polls reflected pretty much accurately the national vote, where Hillary Clinton won the national vote but lost in the Electoral College because she lost about three states, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, by vote margins of less than 100,000 votes in some cases, some less than 40,000 votes in other cases. The polls in those individual states were not as accurate as pollsters had hoped. For the most part, many of the polling companies that do conduct opinion surveys have changed some of their methodologies, taking into account a key demographic factor, which is the education the electorate. The 2016 election showed that Donald Trump outperformed Hillary Clinton in a demographic category of non-college educated white men and women. And that's where his vote surged. And most pollsters did not see this coming in 2016. In 2020, they've adjusted their models, they've adjusted their methodology. And most of the observers of how polling is conducted, they're saying that for the most part, these polls are relatively accurate. They reflect some changes in the methodology. And for the most part, many, many people are trusting the polls while still saying, but wait a minute, we saw what happened in 2016, so let's not put all of our trust in all of these polls.
That was VOA executive producer Steve Reddish. Both Trump and Biden are campaigning today in the closely contested state of Florida. Trump won Florida in 2016. The latest polls this year show Biden with a slight lead over Trump in the state. U.S. military veterans tend to vote Republican in presidential elections, and a majority will likely do so again this year. But VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb talks to some veterans who are reconsidering their political leanings.
A recent Military Times poll shows 52% of veterans plan to back President Donald Trump this election.
I think a lot of people are looking at President Trump and saying, I can vote for him for the simple fact that promises made, promises kept.
Fifth-generation combat vet Jeff Jordan, who served in Iraq and Afghanistan, applauds Trump's Afghanistan troop reduction and peace negotiations with the Taliban.
I think at this point, the right thing to do is pull back because, look, we've been in Afghanistan nearly 20 years. What do we have to show for that?
Not only has Jordan thrown his support to Trump, he decided to run for Congress.
The veteran community is important to me.
A big part of his platform is outreach to older veterans, like Vietnam vet and Trump supporter Curtis Herrick.
If you believe he's a nasty personality and don't think about all the rest, you might throw the baby out with the bathwater because he's really getting things done.
Herrick says he values Trump's decision-making skills.
He works about 20 hours a day, and he decides really quickly. When President Obama had the first surge, he anguished for 9 months before he'd make the decision.
But about 42% of veterans polled said that by November 3rd, they will have voted for Trump's Democratic challenger, former Vice President Joe Biden. That includes longtime Republican and Marine vet Jim Naylor.
I've never voted Democrat.
Who voted for Trump in 2016.
It was a big regret after that. I felt dirty about it.
Hi, my name is Jim.
Naylor created a viral video for the group Republican Voters Against Trump in 2020 after Trump criticized veterans and service members, including the late Senator John McCain, Trump's former defense secretary Jim Mattis, and Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, who testified against Trump on Ukraine during impeachment proceedings. Naylor also said Trump's troop pullout from Syria last October dishonored the military.
He didn't send them home. He sent them just to countries, to his quote, that are paying for us to be there. He sent them to Saudi Arabia because Saudi Arabia pays. That seems so antithetical to what we go out there to fight for. We're not mercenaries. We don't fight for the highest bidder. We fight for what's right.
Nearly two-thirds of female vets polled by the Military Times disapprove of Trump's presidency.
This is a hat for my first ship.
As a former ship navigator, Navy vet Lauren Sims compares Trump's handling of the coronavirus pandemic to steering a ship through a storm.
Donald Trump's job is to set a course for our country and make course corrections in terms of this pandemic and fighting it. And he hasn't. He hasn't set a course, let alone corrections. And it's really scary. I truly believe Joe Biden is a person that will do that.
Much like undecided voters in the general population, a small percent of veterans polled are split between third-party candidates or sitting out the election.
My choices, in my view, are either cyanide or, you know, arsenic.
Iraq War veteran Josh Hill voted third party last time in protest and once again does not like any of the choices. Carla Babb, VOA News, Washington.
A knife attack in a French church left three dead Thursday, the third attack in 2 months in France. For the latest, I spoke to journalist Catherine Field in Paris.
It was just after 9 a.m. local time in the southern French city of Nice. A man, a lone attacker, went into the church of Notre-Dame de Nice in the center of Nice. There he attacked two people in the church, killed them. One of them had their throats cut. He then approached a man who had left the church and had sought refuge in a local cafe, and he was then killed there. Police were quickly on the scene. They shot and wounded the attacker. He is now being treated in a local hospital.
And is there any indication who the attacker is?
Reports from the scene from the mayor of Nice say that they are convinced that this attack is a terrorist attack. They say that it has all the hallmarks of the type of Islamist-inspired attacks that we have seen in France in the last few years. The investigation has already been handed over to investigators from the anti-terror division of the Justice Department. This is in line with a whole range of attacks that France has been suffering since 2015.
What's the reaction been from French leaders?
Political reaction we have had from the Prime Minister. The French Prime Minister, Jean Castex, was in fact making a speech to the National Assembly, the French Parliament. At the time when news came through of the attack, he was addressing Parliament with news of the lockdown. He stopped his address. He said to parliamentarians that this attack had taken place, and he called for unity. And immediately, members in the chamber stopped what they were doing, and there was a minute's silence in memory of the three who have lost their lives in this attack.
And this is not the first attack like this. This is the third in just the last 2 months. Can you give us some context here about previous attacks in France?
The most shocking for many people here was less than 2 weeks ago when an intermediate school teacher was beheaded after some pupils complained that he had shown them cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. We've also, of course, not to forget, got ongoing here in Paris the trial of the accomplices for that 2015 attack on Charlie Hebdo magazine here in Paris, that attack which left 17 people dead. Again, we're going to be hearing a lot more about this attack in Nice, because in July 2016, 86 people lost their lives, 450 were injured in a terrorist attack on the promenade there. So it's been a really difficult time for France, as these sort of lone wolf attacks, which the police just really don't seem to be able to get a handle on. These are single men just armed with a knife or armed with a truck who are able to cause such fear and with such deadly consequences.
That was journalist Catherine Field in Paris. In related developments, Reuters reports that within hours of the Nice attack, police killed a man who had threatened passersby near the southern French city of Avignon in a separate incident. Meanwhile, French President Emmanuel Macron said he would deploy thousands more soldiers to protect key sites in France, including places of worship and schools. And the AP reports that a Saudi man stabbed and slightly wounded a guard at the French consulate in the city of Jeddah Thursday, authorities said. France urged its citizens in Saudi Arabia to be, quote, on maximum alert, end quote. This is VOA. Vietnam state media say Typhoon Molave has blown away from Vietnam after killing at least 35 people and leaving dozens of others missing in the country's central region, the AP reports. The casualties included 19 villagers who died in landslides. 12 crew members died after their two fishing boats sank as the typhoon approached. Rescuers were digging Thursday for survivors. Officials say Molave was the worst typhoon to hit the country in 20 years. More than 1,000 trees owned by Palestinian farmers have been burned or damaged in the Israeli-occupied territory since the annual olive harvest began 3 weeks ago, a United Nations report says. The October 23rd report by the UN Humanitarian Affairs Office has also logged 19 disruptions, quote, by people believed or known to be Israeli settlers, end quote, with 23 Palestinian farmers injured. The settlers dispute those figures, Reuters reports. For many West Bank Palestinians, olive trees are revered cultural emblems and economic necessities, but they have become a flashpoint in the land dispute between Palestinians and Israeli settlers. The mayor of the U.S. city of Philadelphia said National Guard troops would deploy as soon as tomorrow to help protect property and assist police. That follows protests against the Monday police killing of a black man, Walter Wallace Jr. The AP reports that after a citywide curfew was ordered, there was no sign Wednesday of the massive protests of the previous two nights, but some vandalism and arrests were reported. Police say they fatally shot Wallace after telling him to drop a knife. Wallace's mother said she warned police that her son was having a mental health crisis. Police have not released a recording of the emergency call the family made for help or body cam footage of the shooting. Listening to International Edition on the Voice of America, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. The World Health Organization warns nearly 18 million people in Yemen are unable to get treatment for deadly diseases. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
More than 5 years of escalating conflict have devastated Yemen's economy and ability to provide enough food and medical care to keep its population healthy. World Health Organization officials report only half of the country's health facilities are fully functioning, and those that remain open suffer from severe shortages of qualified staff, essential medicines, and supplies. WHO spokesman Tarek Jazarevich says that for 3 years, appalling socioeconomic conditions in Yemen have caused a spiraling of deadly diseases, including the worst cholera outbreak in modern times, as well as epidemics of diphtheria, dengue, measles, and malaria.
Now we have also COVID-19, and unfortunately we have cases of polio coming back to Yemen after it has been declared as a polio-free country. And for people who have chronic diseases such as cancer, diabetes, or others, the treatment is limited.
WHO reports 2,065 confirmed cases of COVID-19, including more than 600 deaths. It notes two new cases of vaccine-derived cases of polio have been confirmed. The outbreak of this extremely contagious disease has paralyzed 17 children. Jazarevich says armed conflict and political instability have disrupted the delivery of essential health care and supplies. He tells VOA the Sana'a International Airport has not been in operation since September 9th, and this is a major obstruction in efforts to respond to COVID-19 and other diseases.
According to our office there, this has delayed the arrival of COVID-19 experts, the arrival of critical medical, but also other humanitarian supplies that include 207 tons of COVID-19 response equipment.
Jazarevich says WHO is critically short of money to fund its humanitarian operation. He says the agency has received less than half of the $164.5 million it needs. Unless money is urgently received, he warns 9 million people will lose access to basic health care services by the end of the year. In addition, he says, as many as 18 million people, including 6 million children, will be deprived of the life-saving vaccines to immunize them against deadly diseases such as measles and polio. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Azerbaijan and Armenia accused each other of killing civilians by shelling cities in and around Nagorno-Karabakh in an escalation of a month-long conflict over the mountain enclave that has defied three ceasefires. Azerbaijan said Wednesday 21 people were killed when Armenian shells hit the town of Barda, northeast of Nagorno-Karabakh. Armenian-backed officials in Nagorno-Karabakh said Azeri shells had fallen on the enclave's two largest cities, killing one person. Both sides denied each other's claims. Accurate casualty numbers for the conflict are difficult to ascertain, as AP's Charles de Ledesma reports.
According to Nagorno-Karabakh officials, well over 1,000 of their troops and nearly 40 civilians have been killed in the clashes so far. Azerbaijani authorities say the fighting has killed under 100 civilians and wounded just over 300. Russian President Vladimir Putin said last week the death toll from the fighting was nearing 5,000, significantly higher than what both sides report. The government-run Armenian Unified Info Center says Azerbaijani forces have targeted a maternity hospital, while Azerbaijan officials reject the accusations. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
In Australia, scientists said they have discovered a detached coral reef on the Great Barrier Reef that is even taller than iconic buildings like the Empire State Building and the Eiffel Tower. Libby Hogan of Reuters reports.
Scientists have discovered a massive detached coral reef taller than the Empire State Building. It's the first discovery of its kind in over a century, and the reef is healthy and thriving. Footage captured by scientists shows clownfish paddling between vibrant peach and pink coral, a colourful scene found last week by a team from James Cook University. Marine scientist Dr. Robin Beeman led the mission.
It was real eye-opener to bring the ROV up over the ledge, literally climb onto the summit and then peer around in the warm photic water to see all of the fish and coral and sharks there. So very healthy coral ecosystem on this, top of a 500-metre tall reef. It's not something you discover every day.
The nearly mile-long structure was named the Blade Reef for its sharp peak and was found by using an underwater robot named Sebastian. And with its help, the team collected samples to be archived.
We've found new fish species, new black coral species. We have been taking samples with the ROV because it has a hand, and we have a permit from the Marine Park that allows us to collect these rare corals.
This part of the seabed stands in contrast to the northern part of the Great Barrier Reef, which is suffering from bleaching. That is where warm water causes coral to expel the algae that feeds it, and ecosystems are destroyed.
We didn't see any evidence of bleaching. What we saw instead was quite a thriving coral reef and sponge community, probably more fish than we've seen on any of the other ROV dives.
The discovery is a welcome breakthrough for scientists, after a study was published earlier this month that found the Great Barrier Reef had lost more than half its coral in the last three decades.
That was Reuters' Libby Hogan. That's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Three Seas Initiative includes 12 democratic countries located between the Baltic, Black, and Adriatic Seas. It aims to promote new infrastructure investments, thus promoting north-south connectivity, economic growth, and energy security as a hedge against the malign influence of authoritarian regimes such as Russia and China. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo recently addressed the Three Seas Summit, urging member states to seize opportunities in front of us to improve the lives of our people.
We have an opportunity to jumpstart growth and attract private sector investment now while raising living standards for the long term. Also, we have an opportunity to link together our infrastructure and energy markets in ways that will generate economic security for generations to come.
A well-funded, action-oriented Three Seas Initiative will help achieve these shared goals, said Secretary Pompeo. But even now, he warned, the authoritarians in Moscow and Beijing are dangling infrastructure deals as a way to gain strategic and political leverage over free people. We've seen this with Nord Stream 2. We've seen the crushing effects of Chinese infrastructure deals around the world, from Laos to Montenegro and to Pakistan. The United States does not want to see authoritarian powers again compromise the sovereignty or liberty of free nations. Indeed, the U.S. has demonstrated that resolve by announcing it would invest up to $1 billion in Three Seas infrastructure projects. Secretary Pompeo urged those Three Seas member states that have not yet invested in the fund to do so now, and other member states to make additional investments. The next step must be to leverage the private sector. To do that, said Secretary Pompeo, there must be a fair and level playing field. It's essential that national policies be as attractive as possible, not favor state-owned enterprises or put politics in the way of their investment. Another concern is security. The Chinese Communist Party is just waiting to vacuum up your data, warned Secretary Pompeo. Unreliable vendors must be excluded from critical telecommunications, energy, and transportation networks. Finally, it is critical that words become action, said Secretary Pompeo. I urge you to move the first of the transnational projects from concept to shovel-ready stages very quickly. As you move forward, you should know you will not be alone, said Secretary Pompeo. We stand with our European friends on the mighty bedrock of freedom and democracy, a foundation of friendship now and for the ages to come.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States.